There's only two ways to go through life. One is your way, and the other way is God's way. One is doing your own will, whatever that is, and one is seeking God's will. And the crazy part of it is that God's will is always a little different than ours, and God's wisdom is always different than worldly wisdom. In Zechariah 9:9, there was a prophecy made. It says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." So it's this word to the city of Jerusalem that your king is coming. And you can just imagine the excitement and anticipation of the king finally coming into the capital city. And you can imagine there's a line of soldiers coming in front with big shining shields and swords and banners. And then there's going to be attendants following with fancy robes. And then there's going to be this carriage pulled by a bunch of pairs of horses and this beautiful chariot. And sitting on top of it, you imagine a king with a big king beard and a big king crown and a big king sword. It's like you imagine the president's coming to town. The president's going to be passing through your town, and the Boy Scouts go and stand at attention with a flag, and the cheerleaders go do their little cheer thing, and old men talk about the time Nixon drove through town and threw a cigarette butt out the window. But then when he comes, there's the line of big black Suburbans, and everybody's waiting for the shiny Cadillac. And instead, there comes a little kid on a rusty, huffy bike. And everybody scratches their head. Jerusalem was promised the king, excited for the coming king. And the first time the king comes to town, he's a little baby named Jesus, brought to the temple to be prayed for, spitting up on his mom's shoulder, needed to be nursed to be kept quiet, and there's their king. Brought in on a colt, Joseph and Mary with the donkey. And the last time the king enters Jerusalem again, he comes up on the donkey. Everybody's ready for a real king, take control of Jerusalem. But God's wisdom is different than worldly wisdom. We read in Matthew 11:25, Jesus says, "I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and understanding and revealed them to little children." Then he goes on, "At that time the disciples came to Jesus, saying, 'Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, 'Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea." In our culture, we set up role models, and we have people that we look up to or aspire to live like. And it's people who've been successful for whatever reason, whether it was in business or politics or the arts, that they went through some stuff and they proved themselves successful, and that's who we pick as a role model. And Jesus turns it all upside down and picks a random kid from the group. got some drool on his chin, mess in his diaper, snot on his sleeve, and Jesus says, here's your role model. And unless you come to me like that, you're not coming. What do you mean? He's talking about a childlike faith. Just a childlike belief and trust. And I'm grateful for what I've learned and learned in the last few years, I guess. But at the same time, part of me still misses the me when I was a kid. Because I remember in grade school one day reading Jesus' words, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, which is tiny, tiny, smaller than a BB, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, be cast in the sea, and it will go in the sea. And I didn't know anything about hyperbole back then. So you know what I did? There was a pencil on my desk. And I looked at that pencil and said, man, I got more faith than a mustard seed. Pencil be thrown across the floor. And you won't believe me if I told you, but the pencil didn't go anywhere. But I had that faith that if you read Jesus' word, it's just that simple. You just act on it. And I remember a couple of years later reading the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5-7. And it wasn't just some old words in a book. And it wasn't confirmation homework or whatever. It was this whole different way of living. I mean, we had some people in our extended family who had a lot of money, and I remember kind of being envious of that. And then you read Jesus' words that don't build up a kingdom where robbers can come and steal and wrath can come and destroy, but build a kingdom that robbers can't steal and rust and moth can't destroy. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all this will be added unto you. That changed my life. And I remember in ninth grade reading Proverbs 31 about this ideal wife and this way to, if you're going to get married, this is what to look for in a woman. And I had a plan of what an ideal wife was. She was right there on the cover of Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition. Didn't take any thinking. You don't need a Bible to figure that out. But then you read just a different approach. That character holds up way more than beauty does. Jesus goes on in Matthew 18 and says, see that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. And I honestly have no idea how that all works. If we have little kids have angels and then you age out of it or what, but there it is. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep, and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Jesus tells this same parable twice. In Luke 15, he's talking to a group of worldly sinners and self-righteous Pharisees. And he tells this parable right before he talks about the prodigal son story. So if you think of there's 99 sheep and then there's this one who's lost, an environment of worldly sinners and before the prodigal son story, how old is that sheep? 18 to 25. It's a good season for sinning, right? And what are their sins? You know, whatever it is, drunkenness, wasting money, sexual immorality down the road. But then Jesus tells this parable again in the context of picking up a child and saying, this is the faith you are called to. And that parable is completely different. That our world can put an economic value on the grown-ups. But of what value is that child? And he says, it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. And goes on, then children were brought to him that he might lay his hands on them and pray. The disciples rebuked the people, but Jesus said, let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven. And to summarize all of this, we're just going to jump a little bit further back into the Bible to James 4:6, where it says, God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. God opposes the proud. There's a lot of pride in the world, in our culture, right? Talk about it as a virtue a lot. We got American pride or buff pride or Texas pride or pride parades, the whole deal. Pride's lifted up as a virtue. It says here, God opposes the proud. God hates pride. And last week we talked about God on the throne, right? The creatures hovering about him and the 24 elders saying, no, you alone are worthy. And 100 million angels proclaiming the worthiness of God. I don't want to oppose that God. I don't want him opposed to me, right? God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Jesus lifted up the faith of a child because of their humility and lack of pride. Why would a child be humble and not have the pride that adults do? Because almost everything in their life is a gift. Where do they get their food? It's a gift. Where do they get their clothes? It's a gift. Where do they get their bed? It's a gift. But how do adults answer the same questions? Where do you get your food? Well, I went to work, finished work, got the check, took it to the bank, went to HEB, had a coupon even. But it's all a gift. It's all a gift. When I do new member orientations, I have a few icebreaker questions that are kind of corny, but I tend to use the same ones over and over. This is confession. But one of the questions I've often asked groups of people is, if you could ask God any question, what would you ask him? So if you could ask God any question, what would you ask? And you all probably have an answer. And having asked hundreds of people the same question now, I kind of know what most people are going to say. And so 2/3 of people are going to talk about suffering, right? Like, why is there suffering? Why is there cancer? Why is there hurricanes? Why did Fluffy get run over by the bulldozer, or whatever it is. It's a big question about suffering with respect to suffering you've experienced in your life. And then there's a small group of people who have another question, which is more about like, what's the purpose? What's the reason for my existence? What am I supposed to be doing with my life? And every now and then you get a random weird question. I've asked this question to hundreds of people. And this week I was talking to another pastor, and he actually uses the same thing as an icebreaker sometimes in church stuff. But he was telling me about one answer he got, where he was in a group and they started kind of going around and, you know, what would you ask God? And as a sidebar, to be honest, everything I've read in this book, when somebody stands before God, they don't stand for long. And if they come to God thinking they're going to question God, they tend to hit their floor on the face and just proclaim the holiness of God and their unworthiness. So in reality, you know, when we seek God, it's not going to be us asking the questions. But this pastor was going around the room, you know, if you could ask God any question, if you could ask God any question, what would you ask? And it was the predictable answers, you know. Great Aunt Millie's, cancer on her fingernail, or, you know, whatever it is, kind of going around the room. But it was all about me. All about me. All about me. And my suffering, and my pain, and my future. And as he went around the table, there was a little boy there. And he was going to skip over him because, you know, it's a little boy. He's not really seen the world. He's not really been through anything. It's not even been confirmed or to Sunday school. Like, what's he going to ask God? So the pastor asked this little boy, his voice full of condescension, "So, little Billy," that's not really his name, it was really Timmy, "what would you ask God if you could ask God any question?" You know what he said? "How can I help you today?" It would have been one thing for God to save the world using a royal king, successful leader, powerful speaker. It's a whole nother thing for God to save the world out of the mouths of babes and infants.